This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, prospects for peace in Afghanistan. Does growing violence and mixed messages about U.S. drawdown of troops threaten the Afghan peace process? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The war in Afghanistan, sparked by the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks on U.S. soil, has now become the longest war ever fought by the United States. In an effort to bring this conflict to an end and spur reconciliation between the Taliban and Afghan government, the United States and the Taliban in February 2020 signed a historic agreement. The accord contains a condition-based timeline for the withdrawal of U.S. and coalition troops and states that neither the Taliban nor the Afghan government will use terrorism or threaten the security of Washington or its coalition allies. It also provided for the start of inter-Afghan negotiations last month in Doha, Qatar, between the Taliban and the Afghan government, the goal of which is to resolve differences and produce a roadmap for Afghanistan's political future and comprehensive permanent ceasefire. However, a surge in violence by the Taliban, as well as mixed messages from Washington regarding the timing of a U.S. troop withdrawal, have complicated the process. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports that on Wednesday, October 7, U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted that he wanted all U.S. forces to return home from Afghanistan before the end of the year. His tweet, which said, quote, "We should have a small remaining number of our brave men and women serving in Afghanistan home by Christmas," close quote. This statement contradicted his national security advisor, who said hours before President Trump's tweet that Washington would draw down from about 5,000 troops in Afghanistan to about 2,500 by early next year. Many national security and Afghan experts worry that President Trump may have made this announcement for political purposes before the election, and that the tweet actually emboldens the Taliban. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports that the U.S. government says that the Afghanistan-Pakistan region harbors at least 20 terrorist groups, more than anywhere else in the world. Babb quotes national security expert Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution, who says, quote, "I don't think we can pull out of Afghanistan right now. I think that for one thing, it would condemn the country to a much more intense civil war," close quote. Notwithstanding the start of peace talks in Doha, in recent days, the Taliban have carried out one of their largest offensives in the southern province of Helmand. Analysts and the Afghan people worry that this growing wave of violence will undermine the peace talks. The assault near Lashkar Gah, the provincial capital, was partially quashed by Afghan forces with support from U.S. airstrikes. Nonetheless, according to Washington Post reporter Pamela Constable and Sharif Hassan, thousands of families were forced to flee the surrounding areas. Highways were blocked, and some Taliban fighters were reported to still be advancing into the city, close quote. On this edition of Encounter, we will talk with our experts about the impact of the violence on the peace process and to what extent a precipitous withdrawal of U.S. forces would bolster the Taliban to push harder or perhaps reduce violence and allow talks to proceed. Well, with us via Microsoft Teams to analyze the state of play in Afghanistan are two distinguished regional analysts. Michael Kugelman is Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. That's a think tank here in Washington. He is a leading specialist on Afghanistan, India, and Pakistan and their relations with the United States. And Scott Smith, he's a senior expert for Afghanistan peace processes at the U.S. Institute of Peace. That's also based here in Washington. Previously, Scott was the director of USIP's Afghanistan and Central Asia programs. He also served as director for political affairs at the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan from 2017 to 2019. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams as we continue to social distance during the pandemic. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. First to you, Michael. Let's address this uptick in violence perpetrated by the Taliban just as peace talks were getting started. How serious is this uptick in violence, and why do you think they're doing this just as peace talks are getting underway?
Well, what we've seen play out in is quite significant, just because I think this is the most intense violence that we've seen since the Taliban and the Afghan government began negotiating in September. But unfortunately, what we're seeing playing out is neither new nor surprising, and that is because this has been the Taliban's pattern for the entire extent of the peace and reconciliation process, which is still in a relatively new phase. The Taliban has been perfectly comfortable and willing to fight while it talks. And what it essentially is doing in recent days and what it's been doing in recent weeks is it wants to ramp up the violence to strengthen its bargaining position in negotiations with the Afghan government. It wants to put enough pressure on the Afghan government negotiating team that those negotiators are willing to make concessions and give in to the types of things that the Taliban would demand as we get into talks. It's become a cliche now that for the Taliban, violence is leverage. That is its main tool of leverage. And I think it's unlikely to expect the Taliban to agree to what has been a major and really the core demand of Kabul as well as Washington and other key actors as well. And that is for the Taliban to agree to a ceasefire early on in the talks so that we don't have what's been playing out in Helmand playing out. But I think that's very unlikely. I think what's more realistic is to hope that in the coming days, the Taliban would agree to some type of violence reduction plan, and there are indications that there is some progress along those lines. There have been continuous meetings between the Taliban and the Afghan side and U.S. officials as well. So the hope is that eventually the types of violence that was seen in Helmand in recent days will at least be reduced, which would therefore make it a bit more appealing and easy for the Taliban and the Afghan government sides to make more progress in what to this point has been a very fledgling negotiation process.
Turning to you, Scott, for your take, the violence might be reduced, but there's no reason why the Taliban wouldn't start again. This seems to be problematic, but how do you see it?
No, I think Michael is exactly right. Violence is the Taliban's main source of leverage. I think they want to demonstrate to the Afghan government and the Afghan negotiating team that they remain capable of inflicting damage, that they are not fragmented, that they haven't been weakened. And they have an internal reason as well, which is they need to maintain the motivation of their own fighting forces. It's not clear, because the Taliban are notoriously opaque, how much the rank and file agrees with the peace agreement that was made. I tend to think, given the evidence from the ceasefires that happened in 2018 and last year, that probably there are quite a few who are tired of fighting, but there are probably some hardliners as well who might think that too much was given up. So there's a sort of tendency on the part of the Taliban leadership to keep the fighting machine warm to a degree, which is why, since the signing of the agreement between the U.S. and Taliban in February, we've seen numerous attacks against small Afghan units, because the Taliban did agree not to attack international forces, and they did agree not to attack provincial capitals and larger units. What is curious is the fighting which has happened in Helmand over the past 5 or 6 days has come very close to a provincial capital of Lashkargah. So this is a bit harder to explain, because they risk violating the agreement that they've been arguing should be the very basis of the negotiation with the Afghan government. One of the sticking points in Doha right now, one of the reasons they haven't gotten even to agree on a set of rules and procedures, is the Taliban has said this agreement between us and the United States should be, as they call it, sort of the mother document of the process. But as I just said, they're coming very close to violating that agreement.
So turning back to you, Michael, that leads me to my next question. It seems that this uptick in violence that they're perpetrating, that is the Taliban, is a signal that they do not intend necessarily to abide by other terms of the agreement. And there are very serious terms, renouncing Al-Qaeda, you know, making way for U.S. troops to leave, but not on a timetable. We'll get to that in a minute. What about those other terms of the agreement?
You bring up a good point, Carol, that everything does come back to the U.S. Taliban deal, because that's what set in motion the process leading to the inter-Afghan dialogue that's now begun. And this is a document that the Taliban has pointed to as the thing that has to be adhered to in a very literal sense. Now, the problem is it's actually relatively unclear as to what that U.S.-Taliban agreement entails. I mean, there is a 3.5-page document that was released to the public, in which many of us have read many times through, And it doesn't say all that much at the end of the day. It does hold the Taliban to several commitments. The big one is the one you mentioned, this notion of the Taliban not letting international terror groups and specifically Al-Qaeda using Afghan soil to mount attacks. There's no indication that the Taliban has severed its ties with Al-Qaeda. There's actually indications that there continue to be high-level meetings between Taliban officials and Al-Qaeda officials in recent months. But the agreement doesn't lay out any type of time frame by when specifically there has to be indications that the Taliban is breaking off ties with Al-Qaeda, if that has to happen before the talks process begins or at what point. The bottom line in that U.S.-Taliban agreement is that essentially the Taliban has to make its commitments to deny space to Al-Qaeda, several other things, within a period of time, which basically translates to the spring of next year. And at that point, assuming the Taliban has done what it needs to do, upholding its commitments, at that point, U.S. forces would conclude their withdrawal from the country. And the bottom line is it's very hard to assess that agreement, that U.S.-Taliban agreement, because there's so much that we really don't know about it. But final point on this, you know, I think many critics have said that the U.S.-Taliban agreement is a flawed agreement, given that it doesn't really expect the Taliban to do much other than basically to deny space to Al-Qaeda, whereas the U.S. is meant to do a lot more, such as trying to get Taliban leaders off U.N. sanctions list and eventually pulling troops out of the country. It's a reflection of the broader point that the Taliban has been getting a lot of what it's wanted so far in this broader peace and reconciliation process. It got the exclusive direct bilateral talks with the Afghan government that it wanted without Kabul in the room. It got a deal that works to its advantage. And now it's having this intra-Afghan dialogue play out where it has refused to agree to a ceasefire, and yet talks have begun without a ceasefire, and it's continued to intensify its violence. So to me, that's one of the things that I really worry about, that so much of what's played out on this peace and recon front has been on the Taliban's terms. And it just has a lot of leverage because it knows at the end of the day that the U.S., and regardless of who's in control of the White House come January of next year, the U.S. is intent on withdrawing troops, maybe not all of them, but close to all of them. And I don't necessarily think that that time frame for a withdrawal of U.S. forces will be aligned with progress in peace talks, which means that even if peace talks are floundering in the coming weeks and months, that doesn't mean that the U.S. government will decide to slow down, much less halt, its withdrawal of forces.
So turning to you, Scott Smith, for your comment on that point, the U.S.-Taliban agreement, you know, what makes any of us believe that, you know, if they're already beginning to violate the terms with the violence in terms of the inter-Afghan talks, what makes us believe that they're going to be sticking to other very important points?
Yeah, Carol, that's a crucial question. And one of the effects of the violence which is taking place right now is that it feeds into the arguments of many people in Washington and in Kabul and elsewhere who say that the Taliban were never really serious about a negotiation process. In fact, they used it as a tactic. Among the concessions, to add to what Michael mentioned, were the release of 5,000 of their prisoners held by the Kabul government, some of them, you know, very notorious people, very skilled in violence. So there's an argument that either way they win, and that they were never serious about the negotiation process. I'm not quite convinced of that. I think that they are serious about the process to the degree to which they think they can get what they were seeking on the battlefield through talks, which is why they're being so intransigent. The pattern of their negotiations so far, especially in the 6 months between when the agreement was signed between the U.S. and the Taliban and now, has, I think, been to look to the U.S. to get the Kabul government to deliver concessions. And that worked for a while, but I think at this point, they really need to negotiate with their Afghan counterparts, and the U.S. really needs to step back and sort of say, our role was to get you to face-to-face and talk about a political future. If there's going to be any side that we pick, the side that we should pick should be the side of the Afghan Republic, which shares, you know, many more of the values that we do. Final point is, if you ask the Taliban, they would say, well, we are honoring the agreement. So I think we had an expectation that one of the things that would happen following the signing of the agreement in February was that there would be a reduction of violence on the part of the Taliban. And even once negotiations began with the Afghan parties, there would be perhaps talks about a ceasefire. That would be high on the agenda. We haven't seen this happen. We've seen an intensification of the violence. But the Taliban would say, yes, it's an intensification, but it's still within the rules of what we committed to on paper. In other words, we're not attacking you. We're not attacking provincial capitals. So we are abiding by the agreement. And the difference is in between, I think, what was unspoken, maybe what we hoped for, but maybe what the Taliban had no intention of delivering on. And that's where we need to try to read what the Taliban strategy is in continuing this violence and continue to make that assessment of that central question, which is, are they actually committed to a negotiation process, which means being willing to make compromises, or is this just a tactical maneuver for them that allows their violence to show the government is weakening and part of an overall military strategy to take over by force?
We'll have more in just a moment. First, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Michael Kugelman. He's Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. And Scott Smith, from whom you just heard, he's Senior Expert for Afghanistan Peace Processes at the U.S. Institute of Peace. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, speaking of Afghanistan, here's a shout out to a longtime listener and Facebook fan from Kabul, Mohammed Basir. Thanks, Mohammed. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We have a lot to go and not much more time. So let me go back to you, Michael Kugelman. What about U.S. leverage? And what do you make of President Trump's statement about withdrawing U.S. troops, bringing them home perhaps by Christmas, which caused great consternation among military here in the United States? I'd like to get your take on that. What impact does this have on the peace process? Do you think it emboldens the Taliban, undermines their objectives? Could it be helpful? I mean, what are the thoughts in Kabul and elsewhere?
My own view is that we really should not overstate the significance of Trump's tweet. Of course, we live in an era where Twitter is important, and we do have cases of policy being declared on Twitter, but I do not think that was the case when Trump said that all remaining U.S. troops should come home by Christmas. And the key term there is should. You know, he was clearly saying that it would be great to have all of our troops home by Christmas. It was a political statement. It was not a declaration of policy, and I think that's quite clear at this point. But certainly, you ask if it emboldens the Taliban, sure, because I think that it reinforces to the Taliban the fact that at least President Trump, can't speak for other senior U.S. leaders, that President Trump is clearly very keen to get all the troops out of Afghanistan. At the end of the day, if there's one thing that the Taliban has been consistent on in its messaging, this being a group that, as I think Scott said before, is famously opaque and famously ambiguous, it has always said that it wants all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. But I don't think we should overstate what Trump said. Now, look, the U.S. has two main tools of leverage. One is its military posture, its troop presence, and the other is aid. And as we've already discussed, it's a bit unclear as to what's going to become specifically of the troop presence, but I do think that there's pretty strong bipartisan support in Washington for the idea of there not being a continued extended military presence. And that suggests to me that it is probably unlikely that the U.S. would be willing to reduce, much less halt, its withdrawal of forces if it thinks that things are not going well at the negotiating table and if it wants to try to put more pressure on the Taliban. That would be a way to use leverage. I'm not completely certain that would actually happen. And the other thing is aid. I mean, we all know that Afghanistan is heavily dependent on U.S. military and economic assistance. And the Taliban itself has indicated that it would welcome continued assistance from the U.S. if there were to be a political settlement in which the Taliban has a role. And I think that there would be hesitation, broadly speaking, within the international donor community to make commitments to longer-term assistance if it knows that the bulk of the foreign forces contingent is heading out of Afghanistan. But, you know, if you look at history, if you look at the example of the Soviet occupation in Afghanistan, what was clear is that once Soviet forces left Afghanistan, the country did not experience the deterioration in security at that point. It was only a bit later when the Russian aid stopped coming in. That's when you had a lot of problems. So I think that will be a key thing to watch out for. If the peace talks collapse, or if for whatever reason they don't succeed, and if the Taliban is able to return to the battlefield and is actually able to overthrow the government in Kabul, and it takes power by force, we have a situation like the late 1990s, there will not be any assistance from the United States government, and presumably not from the international donor community on the whole. Only if there's a political settlement leading to a situation where the Taliban has some degree of a role in that arrangement, only then could we still be talking about the likelihood of continued U.S. and broader international support to Afghanistan.
Right, and presumably that would motivate the Taliban, who eventually, if they would join the government and there would be some type of reconciliation, that they would try to cooperate because they also want the aid and wouldn't want to jeopardize that. But back to you, Scott Smith, just to get your take on the U.S. troop withdrawal, to what extent Mr. Trump's tweet might have undermined the U.S. leverage, at least just temporarily, and helped the Taliban. And also, I want to ask you about the wisdom of recommending a small counterterrorism force in the country, even though we will draw down eventually, if not by the end of the year, obviously, but early next year.
Yeah, I agree with Michael that our leverage against the Taliban, for example, is very much the presence of our troops. There's another element to the equation, and I'm not saying that the Trump tweet was directed at this, but the other element is that we also need leverage against Kabul. The Kabul government does not like this process, does not like the agreement that we signed with the Taliban. You could argue that it has been reluctant to engage in the political talks going on right now. It took 6 months. These were supposed to begin in March. President Ghani has been quite clear. He wants peace, but he wants peace on his own terms and not the terms that have been set by the agreement that we signed with the Taliban. So our leverage with the Kabul government, in some sense, not to be too cynical, is the threat to leave. So we've been trying to carry out this balancing act of convincing the Taliban that we're going to stay and convincing the government that we could leave in order to get them in a way to where we've got them. But once they're there, it's true that this tweet definitely undermines the government's position and certainly encourages the Taliban. On the question of a residual counterterrorism force, I think most U.S. policy experts who have been following this issue very closely would say that this will be necessary for some time. A, can we fully trust the Taliban commitment and capacity to do what they say they're going to do, which is make sure that areas under their control will not support or harbor or allow to train terrorist groups that could attack the U.S. homeland? That's not clear. The points about al-Qaeda that have been made, there are reports that from the Afghan government on the ground in Helmand that al-Qaeda is fighting with the Taliban in this current round of fighting. And it's interesting that we used to have a goal of forcing the Taliban to renounce their association with al-Qaeda. This agreement doesn't call for that. This agreement just calls for them not to enable them to attack us. And the fact is that the relationship between the Taliban and al-Qaeda goes back decades, connections that are very difficult for the Taliban to just renounce. And then finally, there's an ISIS chapter or group in Afghanistan as well. They are opposed to the Taliban. The Taliban have been fighting against them, but they still have their designs on the U.S., and they will still be a factor if our troops leave. So all of these things point to, again, a policy consensus, at least, that whatever happens in the talks in Doha, there will need to be some sort of, and even if we withdraw most of our troops, there will still need to be some kind of counterterrorism capacity that remains.
Well, as we close, let's get some closing remarks. So back to you, Michael Kugelman. Anything you want to add with respect to the situation? If you're optimistic, pessimistic, do you see things moving slowly forward, if very, very slowly?
Slowly is the key word. I think that's important, that if you look at comparable negotiations like this with insurgencies and governments, the time frame is measured in years, not the months or even weeks that President Trump, among others, may be looking for. It's significant that it's been very difficult for the two sides to even reach agreement on procedural matters. They haven't even been able to agree on the technical aspects of the talks, much less the big substantive issues.
The form of government, women's rights, these are huge issues, which are very controversial.
Right, exactly. And the two sides, they come into these negotiations with very different opinions, not only in terms of priorities, what should be discussed first in talks, things like that, but also broader worldviews. Each side has a very different idea of what Afghanistan should look like politically, religiously, socially, and so on. But I do think we should look, at least now, at the Taliban as a legitimate partner in these negotiations.
The last word to you, Scott Smith, with respect to how optimistic or not are you that over time reconciliation can occur and peace agreement, certainly ceasefire between the Taliban and Afghan government, or do you see things falling apart?
No, I agree with Michael. I think that they are, the Taliban, committed to the negotiation process. They just might not understand exactly what a negotiation is. Just before coming on, I saw news reports that they had come to an agreement to sort of lay aside the two procedural issues that were a point of contention and move forward to begin setting out a substantive agenda. But it would support the idea that they want this to continue. There's also a statement by Ambassador Khalilzad saying he had spoken with the Taliban and they'd agreed to reduce operations. So we'll have to see if that has an effect on the battlefield.
And on that cautiously optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, and Scott Smith, Senior Expert for Afghanistan Peace Processes at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo and Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.